I want to ground what I'm going to say in the earliest Buddhist traditions of going for refuge. You've probably already heard this, because it's a very ancient idiom, in some ways a rather strange idiom for us moderns, particularly in the West, this whole language of going for refuge. I mean, frequently, I mean, I lead a lot of retreats for men preparing for ordination up at Loka, where I live in Norfolk, and inevitably, whenever you know, because well, we call the retreats going for refuge retreats, because at the heart of our ordination into the Tree Ratman Buddhist Order is the ordination ceremony, and at the heart of that is going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And very often people, frequently, perhaps not very often, it's an overstatement, but fairly frequently people say, I really don't like the language of going for refuge, or I don't relate to the language of going for refuge, and you have to do a bit of an inquiry, you know, into what the problems are, what the issue is. I mean, even some quite long-standing order members are not very comfortable with the language of going for refuge. Maybe this has already been covered, but I think just to kind of orientate myself, I want to start with this. But it's a very, very ancient expression in Buddhism. It's ubiquitous, really, throughout the Buddhist world, and we started this evening with Gnanavacha leading us in the refuges and precepts, where we went for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha three times in body, speech, and mind, before then reciting the precepts, the five basic precepts, as the expression of that going for refuge. But it's become a sort of ceremony throughout the Buddhist world. It has to be said, in many parts of the Buddhist world, for many Buddhists, it doesn't really have a lot of meaning. It's what you do if you're from a Buddhist country. But the origins of it are very profound indeed, and I think it's always worth just meditating on the origins of the tradition. There are many stories, as you probably know, about the Buddha after his enlightenment, after his attainment of the fullness of wisdom and love and compassion and the great qualities of enlightenment. He spent the rest of his days really wandering, except when he was in retreat in the rainy season. But even in the rainy season retreat, he was probably teaching as well as sitting in silence a great deal. But the rest of the year, what would it have been, 8 months or something, he would have wandered. He was a homeless wanderer. He was a samana, as they were known, and he'd wander from place to place, with very often with disciples, sometimes alone, sometimes with just one or two others. And in the course of that wandering, there would be communication with other people. Those other people could be anybody. It's what's very striking with the Buddha is his incredible powers of imaginative identification or empathy. I don't know if that's the right kind of language, but this extraordinary quality of loving kindness, wisdom, actually, to be able to really tune into directly into the people that he was with. So this might be in the course of a formal discourse where he'd be talking to a great crowd of people who would have come, people with all sorts of backgrounds, and he'd be putting together a host of Dharma topics, expressing his realization, expressing his teaching. Maybe even sometimes he'd tell aspects of his own life history. Sometimes it would be in response to a question, maybe even quite an aggressive question from somebody who wanted to sort of, put him in his place. Good luck. It might have been sometimes people with a very urgent question, you know, to do with, you know, their particular circumstances and situation. Sometimes it might just be quite spontaneous. He just wants to delight, if you like, as a sort of free gift, the people who've come along. Sometimes it's just a one-to-one chance meeting with somebody. It could be with a farmer, could be with a housewife, could be with a businessman, could be with a homeless wanderer he meets on the road, a Brahmin priest, a merchant, a playboy. So many people from all sorts of walks of life he gets into communication with. It has to be said that sometimes the person who is listening to the Buddha is kind of not interested, or they're not convinced. I think this is quite significant. The Buddha wasn't always successful in his communication. It's not as if he could just do some magic and take people, you know, without their cooperation to another place. I mean, one of the earliest communications he has with somebody who he meets on the road, fresh from his enlightenment, when he tells him of his realization, this other wanderer says, "May it be so, friend," and walks out of the Buddhist scriptures. Mm-hmm. And I always find that very, never to be heard of again, I always find that very interesting, that it doesn't always work. You know, the communication does have to be two-way. But from what we can gather, fairly often, in the course of this communication, with the Buddha, you know, really present to the person he's talking to, really tuning into their life, into their concerns, and connecting them with the Dharma, the path, with the truth that he's seen, in a way that really reaches them, that really talks to their particular circumstances and gives them a way of really relating to their circumstances, transforming their circumstances. It often happens that the person is really profoundly moved. I mean, and that's an understatement, not just, we use the word moved to kind of mean almost anything, but when I say moved, I mean turned around, turned in a sense upside down and inside out. Something kind of happens in the course of that communication, at the end of which they kind of burst into poetry, into metaphor. Very often they don't just say, "Well, that was really great, thanks," that was really cool, to use the modern idiom, overused idiom. They say things like, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu, well done, good, good. The truth, the Dhamma, has been shown, has been revealed, has been pointed to in so many ways by the Bhagavan, the Blessed One." This is one of the terms for the Buddha, a very honorific term. It's been revealed in so many ways. It's as if that which has been knocked over has been set up straight. You know, as if a great big pillar has been, you know, been lying on the ground for a long time, and now it's just set right. You know, it's exactly how it should be. That which is knocked over is set up straight. It's as if a lamp has been lit, an oil lamp in the Indian context. A lamp has been lit in the darkness so that those with eyes can actually see the forms that are there. So there's just been this darkness, so you can't see. You've got eyes, but you just can't see. But a light is now shining so that you can see. It's as if someone who has been lost for a long time has been shown the way clearly. I think these metaphors are really important in a way. They're very, very simple. They're very straightforward. They're very much to do with very ordinary experience. And, you know, sometimes in our modern context, you find people, when they connect with Buddhism, when they realise, maybe dramatically or maybe over a period of time, they come up with their own sort of words to try and explain what is happening. And a frequent one is, it's as if I have come home. That's used very, very often by people as though they've found their sort of true ground, if you like. They've been sort of a bit of a refugee up until this point, and they've found, you know, like the real, you know, the real home, the real place, the spiritual home, if you like, the dharmic home. I think there are others that people can use, but these are the ones that the early Buddhists use, as if that which is knocked over is set up straight, light is lit in the darkness, a way is shown to someone who is lost. And then they say, I go for refuge to the teacher, in the sense of the Buddha, for refuge I go. To the Dhamma, the truth, for refuge I go. To the Sangha, the community, for refuge I go. As long as breath lasts, I will go for refuge. Very, very powerful statement. As long as breath lasts, or you could even say with every breath, I will go for refuge to the Buddha. There's a tremendous sense of energy, of enthusiasm, of inspiration, and indeed of gratitude. And this language of refuge, and by the way, the I go, the Gacchami, is an emphatic in Pali. It's not just, I go, you know, or I'm coming. It's I go. I'm really setting out in that direction to that refuge, to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, as refuges. Now, very often when people hear the word refuge and going for refuge, the frequent concern about it is that, well, it can makes us sound weak. I don't need a refuge. I'm strong, I'm independent. Why would I need a refuge? And isn't it sort of not turning the Buddha, the Dharma, into Sangha, into sort of something like a god or a saviour or something like that? And it's interesting, that really isn't the understanding in the Indian tradition. That's not the understanding at all. Quite the contrary, actually. It's more the fact that it's really doing a number of things. First of all, it is an expression of, you know, have to understand the context, that the Buddha is actually a living presence, a living teacher with a teaching and a community. So to say that you go for refuge means that you are taking him as the teacher, as your guru, as your spiritual friend, as your master. The traditional Pali word is the sutta, the teacher. Only it's a word only used for the Buddha. Even in that little verse I mentioned, that when people go for refuge, they have a particular saying. They talk about the sutta sarsana. Sorry about all these Pali terms, but they're so resonant for me, I have to say them. The sutta sarsana is another word for the Buddha, another word for the Dhamma. But it brings out a particular kind of element. Sasana means something like, one translation is ordinance, in the sense that it could be teaching, it could be the dispensation or the teaching or the instruction of the Buddha, but it has the connotation, very positive connotation here, that this has real weight and authority for me, a natural authority for me. Not it's being authoritarian, but it's more that you've developed a very strong confidence through seeing the Buddha very clearly, seeing his teaching very clearly, seeing his community very clearly. So that has a real weight for you, a real, you know, even if you don't want to practice it, you still do. It's that kind of atmosphere. You've ever had that sort of feeling sometimes in your life, particularly with a moral issue, an issue of values, maybe in the workplace or the family, you know, or some sort of social situation. Something is happening and you know that you can't go along with it. You know you have to make a stand, even though, actually, I don't want to make a stand here. It's going to make my life really awkward. It's going to bring about me being unpopular, maybe even rejected, but I have to do it. I have to do this thing. It's got into me. This value has got into me. Well, it's like that when people go for refuge. There's this real weight, a positive weight that the teaching has, because the people who are going for refuge have really seen it. So they are taking the Buddha as their teacher, and the Dhamma as their teaching, and the Sangha as the community. So the language of refuge is to do with that. And there's also this with a refuge. A refuge is something that you feel you can rely on. You can deeply rely on. It's not going to let you down. You trust it. There's something in it that you feel that, yes, if I really bang on this, it's not going to sound hollow. If I kind of give it a good beating, it's not going to break. It's going to withstand, you know, all that sort of, you know, questioning. It's going to withstand the ravages of life. And when we look at the term refuge in this way, and the Indian tradition, the Buddha certainly does this. Of course, this is what we're doing all the time. You could actually say the basic activity of unenlightened human beings is to find refuge. That's a sort of fundamental existential activity to do with our very being. We're a lot of the time looking for meaning, security, value. We're looking for those things that we can rely on, that will make us feel okay, that can make us feel good, that gives us a sort of purpose in life. All these sort of terms we use, it covers everything. You know, if you're in difficulty, you're feeling a bit low, I mean, what do you do? You know, what do you actually do to make yourself feel all right? Make a cup of tea, lots of sugar, chocolates, Strictly Come Dancing, booze, relationships, you know, this one's not working, so maybe let's look around for another one, etc., etc. What do we do to feel okay? The fundamental activity of unenlightened human beings is to look for refuge. And very often, though, these refuges break down. The things that we rely on very, very frequently, they break down, or we sense that they're not as they should be. You know, you get people, don't you, all of us, at different sort of phases in our life. We reach these sort of crisis moments. We suddenly wake up one morning and think, oh my goodness, this isn't working. You know, the fantastic job I've got, the fantastic relationship I've got, even this fantastic family I've got, it's not enough. It's not enough. It's not actually answering much deeper questions, you know, like, you know, what do I do with this life that doesn't last forever and that could end at any moment? You know, these things aren't actually speaking, you know, to that within me. So in going for refuge, people are saying they've found that which that they can deeply rely upon. The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. The Buddha, not just as a wise and reliable teacher that they're in relationship, but the Buddha as the embodiment of an ideal, a principle. It's very hard to find the words to describe what the state of enlightenment is. Ideal is probably the best we can do. So when you go for refuge to the Buddha, what one is saying is that I'm placing my reliance on that state, on that state of wisdom and compassion, of waking up, of really seeing the way things are, and in seeing the way things are, having love and compassion for all around me. That is regarded as the most secure state you could possibly arrive at, and you have a sort of feeling for that, a resonance with that. You know, you want to, when you go for refuge to the Buddha, what you're doing is saying, well, in all of my life, throughout the day, I'm turning in the direction of awareness and loving kindness. I mean, wisdom and compassion are very big words. We have to bring it a bit nearer. I'm turning in that direction. Awareness and loving kindness are things I can rely upon. Everything might be falling to bits, but I can turn in that direction. I was very, very struck recently, a few years ago. I had my first sort of semi-serious illness, and I was hospitalised, and it was, you know, it was appendicitis that wasn't diagnosed for a long time, so I was pretty sick. And, you know, it was all getting sorted out, and I was put in a ward with people who were really sick. I mean, they'd had very, very serious, major operations on their insides, and some of them were really distressed, and their families were coming. And okay, I'd had a minor thing, although it was, you know, it was, if I'd left it a bit longer, it could have been pretty serious. And what I found very interesting about it, in being there and observing people, and I didn't feel holier than thou or anything like that, but I thought, well, this is really interesting because I have actually got the information that this is what happens. And I noticed overhearing kind of conversations with, you know, families and, you know, the guys who were around me, that it's like the question was, well, why is this happening to me? As though it was a sort of mistake. And I thought, well, no, you've got a body. You know, I mean, the Buddhist tradition has told me you've got a body. And bodies, this, you know, stuff happens, you know, even if you're the healthiest person in the world. And I found that the thing I could rely on was moving in the direction of awareness and loving kindness. Because I have to admit, I was frightened. You know, I didn't quite know what was going to happen, especially when they said, well, we don't know why your appendix has flared up. You might have cancer, something like that. Oh, thank you. That's very nice. You know, they said it nicely and matter-of-factly. But, you know, it was a bit scary. But at least I had the information that this is what happens. And I had the information of what I could do, you know, with my mind. I could move in this direction. I didn't have to deny what was going on. I didn't have to sort of feel outraged or something like that. This is what happens. And I can actually respond to it in a different way. So I could place my reliance in that sense, in moving in the direction of the Buddha refuge. I had the Dhamma as well, because in going for refuge to the Dhamma, you do have those ideas, at least, that life is impermanent, that life ends in death, that life, you know, that death can happen at any moment. That's a very, very, you know, powerful Buddhist teaching. But not just that, I had the practices. I had the mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, and the different meditation practices that I'd been given. I also, you know, been taught Buddhist ethics, learned Buddhist ethics. So the practice is to, with whoever's in front of you, that you treat them with courtesy and kindness, you know, whatever is going on, whatever state you're in, at least I had that information. So again, I might have been feeling frightened, I might have been feeling in a bit of a mess because of all the drugs that were being pumped into me. But at least I had all this, as it were, at the back of my mind. And of course I had spiritual community, I mean, in the form of friends, people coming to see me, a lot of love from people. You know, I knew people were really caring for me very, very deeply. Not just people who would come to see me on visiting hours, but just in my mind I knew that. I knew that there were people that I loved very deeply, very cleanly, and people that loved me, you know, very deeply. And I would say a love that sort of, in a sense, transcends the, you know, the particular sort of circumstances, whether they're near or far, whether one is sick or healthy. I felt very confident in that love. Not my love for them, not their love for me necessarily. Love. Just love. I had that. So I think this, I found that very heartening in many ways. Even though I felt frightened, insecure and all the rest of it, I thought, well, at least you've got these refuges, these things you can do, things you can turn to, things you've even, to some extent, to a small extent, even internalised a little bit, you know, which can, you know, whatever goes on, it will be okay. This will be okay. Whatever will happen, this will be okay. One of the things that's said in the Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on meditation on death, and very often if you bring up a subject like death, people can get very uneasy. It's, people think, well, if you meditate on death, you must be rather morbid, and you know, it's not something you should really speak about in company, sort of thing. Not something you should really bring up at a party, unless, I suppose, you're into vampires or zombie films or something, yeah, whatever it is. But no, Buddhist tradition says you know, in the right context, in the context of a lot of metta bhavana, a lot of going for refuge, you look at it. you look at it, that the fact that whether you like it or not, you are going to die, that's going to happen. Happens to everybody. Even the great fully enlightened Buddha could not cheat this situation. This happens. So get that fact into consciousness and live your life in the light of that fact. And then of course it can happen at any moment, at any time. It's got, it strikes the Lord of Death with his rough-coated dogs, to use the Indian mythology, can turn up at any moment, at absolutely any moment. And you're asked to meditate on that. And again, not to freak yourself out or to make yourself panicky or anything like that, but so that you live really wisely, really wisely, so that you're prepared, so that you're not sort of when you face that moment of death, you're not in a really sort of negative, miserable, state or something like that. You're in a very creative state. I remember when I was meditating on death quite a lot on a solitary retreat. On this particular solitary retreat, when I'd go for walks, I'd end up having imaginary arguments with people. This is very embarrassing to talk about, but anyway, there you are. These arguments with people that weren't there. Really quite serious arguments, the sort of thing that can happen on my solitary retreat, I don't speak to other people. And then because I was meditating on death regularly, especially that death could come at any time, I thought, hang on a minute, supposing you died at this moment having an argument with somebody not there, I mean, that is a really mad thing to do. Why not sort of wake up to the reality of this situation? And they say, the tradition says, that at the time of death, it's only the Dharma that can really help you to face that situation with creativity. Only the Dharma can be a refuge with that. Not the Dharma as a sort of Buddhist catechism that you recite at the moment of death, or, sort of praying to the Buddha, the Buddha loves me and I know because the sutras tell me so, or something like that. That's not the way it works. It's more like the Dharma in the sense that you are going to be really creative in this situation. You're going to bring full awareness and loving kindness and curiosity to what's happening. I mean, that's what I really aspire to at the moment of death, is to be as conscious as possible through my Dharma training, and to be as curious and responsive, to whatever the, to this unknown, unknown area that will be opening up for me. So in that sense, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha are a refuge in that sense. There's other ways we could talk about it. They're a refuge in that way. And you go to them. You go to them. You can't be passive, in relation to them. You have to go. And going to them means transforming, means turning around in the deepest part of your being and consciousness. It's a sort of revolution in consciousness, going for refuge. You're living with entirely different values on an entirely different basis. I said when I was talking about these early Buddhists who go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that there's obviously a tremendous sense of gratitude to what has been given, a tremendous sense of energy and abundance, and very, very typically that's expressed in a completely different relationship with all of life. This is what the precepts, by the way, kind of represent. They represent what's this going to look like in life? And the first of these is abstaining from harming living beings, and more positively, deeds of loving kindness. Immediately, in other words, there's an altruistic expression. There's an altruistic expression. The in that shift in the direction of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that brings about a changed relationship with all life, with all others. And this is brought out really strongly in later Buddhist tradition, in what's known as the Bodhisattva ideal. And I'm going to spend the rest of this talk talking a bit about the Bodhisattva ideal. This word Bodhisattva, it literally means being of enlightenment or enlightened being. But it's that doesn't really convey its meaning. The Sanskrit word might be a corrupt translation of another term, which means something like energizing for enlightenment, bodhisatta. The bodhisattva is really the being, the individual, who is energizing in the direction of enlightenment. But in later Buddhism, it's another way of describing that going for refuge, that commitment to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But later Buddhists wanted to bring out this, what we call this altruistic direction very strongly. The bodhisattva, or the bodhisatta, is one who is dedicated to enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. And to put it even more strongly, they're dedicated, vowed to enlightenment with all beings. And this can be put very sort of rather impossibly and even a bit sentimentally, if you're not careful, that the bodhisattva, he will, or she, will get enlightened last. They'll usher everybody else into enlightenment and then go in last of all, so that all suffering is alleviated and they'll be the last to sort of not suffer. This makes life a bit difficult in the bodhisattva ideal states, because you're going to get bodhisattvas presumably having a punch up just before nirvana about who's going in last. So you can see when you talk like that, but this is obviously a very poetic expression. The basic point is that later Buddhists are making, really and truly, is that there is no such thing as a spiritual development, a human development, an enlightenment for yourself alone. That is just impossible. If you develop any wisdom worth the name, it will manifest as loving kindness. It will manifest as generosity. It will manifest as compassion. It will manifest as a deeper and a real empathy, with those around you. That's actually just the way it is. There's no such thing as a kind of one-sided enlightenment. If you've done a bit of Buddhist reading, you might have heard of, there's the Hinayana Buddhists who do enlightenment for themselves, and there's the Mahayana Buddhists where we're all enlightened together. I mean, this is all Buddhist sectarian history that really isn't true. If you see into the way things really are, one of the things that you do is see that your sense of having a permanent, separate self apart from other people is a fiction. Useful for getting things done in the kind of common sense, everyday reality, that we occupy. But in the end, it can't really be sustained. But when you see through it, it means that, one of the ways this is quite graphically put, is that you see through the hard and fast distinction between self and other. It's more that the whole notion of self, to use that word in single inverted commas, is kind of transparent. We are sort of transparent, to one another. It's much more that there's an experience of just a sort of flow, an exchange of energies between, self and other. And really, wisdom is about waking up to that. That's why I often say that the most powerful wisdom practice for us, particularly in the West, is the Metta-bhavana meditation. That's the practice that Gnanavacha and others do courses on, and who hates the Metta-bhavana. Well, don't hate it, because it's about developing wisdom. If you really do that practice, not just as a meditation, but it starts to really perfume and overflow into your life, you'll start to be so transparent to others, so involved very, very positively, happily, in the welfare of others, in a creative, life lived not just for yourself but for others as well, that you will be wise, even though you're not self-consciously thinking that you're wise. You just are. you know, you start to learn, you know, what people need. You start to have a much greater awareness of, you know, the needs of other people. You also have a much greater awareness of your own limitations. You don't set yourself up as a big guru teacher thing with this wonderful wisdom that you have. It's not like that. It's more that you've got a much clearer and vivid sense of what's needed, of how to respond. You just befriend. There's, you know, words like wisdom, compassion, love even. They're really, really sort of big words, aren't they? Very dramatic. I must admit, I really don't like this word compassion. I think it invites all the kind of wrong responses of sort of pity and, you know, feeling kind of miserable at the state of the world and all the rest of it. And this isn't really what the Bodhisattva path is like at all. It's much better to think of it in terms of, well, you know what friendship is. You know what it is to be a friend of others. You know what it is to be befriended. Well, you're just widening that circle more and more so that basically anybody you meet is somebody you feel you can befriend, you know, given the right circumstances and the right opportunity. And, you know, a friend is one who helps another. So that's what we're really talking about. That's what's really going on with this altruistic dimension of going for refuge. You could even say that you're going for refuge to love. You're going for refuge to friendship. There's a wonderful Buddhist text called the Vimalakirti Nidesha. And in this, it's a later text. And it's all about this Bodhisattva path, centering around this character called Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti on one occasion talks about the great love, the Maha Maitri, that the Bodhisattva develops to all living beings. And he says he develops, or she develops, the great love that is truly a refuge for living beings. The great love that is truly a refuge for living beings. Because it's a love and kindness and compassion based on reality, based on seeing things as they are, based on seeing the fact that there aren't these hard and separate selves, that everything is change and flux and impermanent and all the rest of it. So it's something real. It's a real love in relation to that. But it also means that the person who develops that love becomes absolutely reliable. I think this is one of the things I really love about you know, our own spiritual community, our own Sangha, over the years, and well, where I live at Padmaloka, very, very supportive environment, living in a retreat centre. Because one of the things you have to learn in an environment like that is reliability. Reliability. You know, being available. And reliable in the sense of your emotional state and, you know, your mental state. You know, that you, I mean, one does have off days, but, you know, you can't afford to indulge your off days too much when you live with 14 other people and you've got people coming on retreat. You know, if you have an off day and you indulge it, you know, somebody, there's a retreat and turning up, maybe their first retreat, and you're in a bad mood and you blank them or are rude to them or something like that. Well, what does that say? What does that say about your wisdom? What does that say about your Buddhism? Not a lot, because it could put them off forever. You know, could put them off forever. What a thought. So you're developing this, you know, being a really reliable friend. You're developing what it means to be a refuge. You've got to go very, very deep with that. So, yeah, I mean, in a way, or perhaps the only point in this talk is that if the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, well, it's not really a dimension, it's what it is. We've actually not got a lot of choice if we're serious. We have to start opening out, you know, to people, to others. We have to start becoming reliable to others. We have to start making a contribution to this world, to this very, well, broken and, you know, beleaguered world that we occupy. But how do we do that? What do we do? What are the pressing needs? It's a funny old world we live in, and funny times, isn't it? With, you know, all this kind of constantly rolling media that comes at us, regularly at all the kind of electronic gadgets that, we have. It can be terrible when it all goes straight to the brain, which presumably it will do one day, I don't know. I'm sure technically they'll be able to do it one day. What a horrible thought. And I know many people can find that terribly overwhelming. Terribly overwhelming, if you live in a big city like London as well. I mean, you see so much. You know, you see so much, you know, suffering, you know, around you. You know, on the tube, you know, you see the marks of weakness, marks of woe, you know, that William Blake saw, you know, back in his time. You know, you see them etched on people's faces as they go to work, as they come from work. You know, you see it in the newspaper, you see it on the news sites and all the rest of it. And you're aware of these terrible things happening in other parts of the world. Just last night I was out with a friend, you know, just down in Stepney Green, and we came out of the cinema, and, you know, there'd been a horrific-looking car crash. You know, this van had smashed into a lamppost, and you know, just done. You know, I don't see that in Norfolk. I don't see that in my little village. I mean, suffering happens there, of course it does. Suffering's everywhere. But, you know, I thought, goodness me, living in London, that's tough. That's hard. You know, because you know, sirens going off. I mean, what particular trauma is going on there? I mean, you're probably used to it, but I stay right at the top in Samagavasa, right at the top of the building. You know, almost, you know, every half an hour or so, there's a siren going off, and you know, part of my mind is thinking, oh, something terrible's happened, you know, to somebody somewhere. So it can be really overwhelming, and there can be a temptation, I think, to feel that, you know, people sometimes say it, you know, at the Buddhist Center, you know, well, what are you Buddhists doing for the terrible sufferings in the world? You know, for the environment, for this, for that, for the other. You know, aren't you being complacent? You know, just doing meditation, building a fantastic new retreat centre, you know, having, you know, a wonderful new Buddha image and all this sort of thing. It can be very, very tempting to think like that. And I think we need to reflect a bit more on you know, the different kinds of suffering that there are. There are so many. But one of the things I think that Buddhists should be particularly concerned with, you know, as well as the obvious sufferings that people respond to, and I know, you know, many people here, you know, are involved in careers in which are like callings, vocations in the different caring, you know, professions and doing wonderful work there. But there's a particular kind of suffering that I don't think is addressed, you know, as much as it should be and could be. You know, there are many casualties of different kinds in our world. But there's a casualty, a hidden casualty, which is in a way the kind of fundamental problem. You could call it an existential casualty. You know, an existential casualty. There are people who are suffering because they cannot give expression to the deeper meaning that they intuit in this life. They intuit that there's something much more to this life than is actually offered to them, than is expected of them. They feel that there's something deep in them that wants to unfold, that wants to transform, that wants to change. And they're kind of alienated from that. You know, they feel it, and they don't even know what the pain's about. But they are a sort of existential casualty. That is what the Dharma is speaking to. And it's not a luxury item. You know, I think sometimes people can think, oh, if they hear you're a Buddhist and you meditate, well, this must be just some sort of, I don't know, middle class, you know, luxurious item that you have, you know, a bit of de-stressing. Well, it's not that. It's not about that at all. It's about something deep and fundamental, you know, in human nature that needs to be addressed, that needs to be developed, that needs to be matured. And a bodhisattva essentially, is concerned with that maturing and ripening of living beings so that they grow and expand in consciousness. Because the bodhisattva sees that is the most meaningful thing that you can do. Sure, if you were in a situation where people were starving and hungry or homeless or diseased, you would respond, you know, to them, to what they actually needed. Well, what happens? What have you got when those things are taken care of? It doesn't mean that everything is okay with people. It doesn't mean that everything is all right. There's something deeper that is not spoken to. And that's what we're preeminently concerned with as a Buddhist community. And, you know, many people believe in the Buddhist community. If that is really addressed, and if people are living from that, communicating through that, that will actually underpin all other kinds of social, political change and transformation. I don't think I'd be able to speak like this, you know, if I hadn't lived in India for many years and lived with the Buddhists in India, that is the Buddhists who converted, who used Buddhism, converted to Buddhism, to renounce untouchability, as it was called, you know, before independence, you know, where they were treated by the Hindu caste system as untouchables, outcasts, unclean, religiously unclean, and denied access to, well, any kind of real human life and human dignity. Well, you know, their great leader, Dr. Ambedkar, B.R. Ambedkar, who was the first law minister in the government of India, who framed the Indian constitution, he led them eventually into Buddhism, that huge community, hundreds of thousands of people into Buddhism. He's a very, very hard-headed, practical man, you know, who worked in, you know, all sorts of spheres, trade unionism, education, politics, social work of all sorts of many different kinds. But he believed very, very, very early on, if there was going to be a transformation in Indian society, there had to be a change in mind, in consciousness, in culture, in religion. And, you know, that's why he chose Buddhism, he chose the Dharma, because it was the clearest tradition in terms of the dignity of the human, the dignity of the human, and gave the practices and teachings to bring that about, to bring about that transformation. So yes, I have a lot of faith in the Dharma because of that, of underpinning any kind of social and political transformation. But I just want to end this talk with a few, how long, when should I finish?
You've got plenty of time.
Have I got plenty of time? Okay. I just want to end this talk with some practical points. When I say the Bodhisattva, it can sound like one sort of superman or superwoman who's set on enlightenment, going around changing the world and carrying people, you know, to nirvana and, you know, and people, you know, if you talk like that, if you think like that, people get worried about things like burnout, you know, which I think is, you know, quite legitimate if you form that idea of it. But that's not really in the tradition the way a bodhisattva works. In one of the traditions which describe this path, it says that what a bodhisattva does, or what bodhisattvas do, there might be more than one of them, is that they gather a community. They create a community. They gather people around. They create a sort of people to work together to really do something. They harmonize a group of people. They kind of do things that just bring people together. Not that they're really thinking, oh, I'm going to do things to bring people together. They communicate. They befriend. But it's as if that's been, the tradition has decided to model, you know, how, what that actually looks like, what they actually do to kind of bring people together, to work together, to make the world a better place. Now, another way this language is spoken about is building the Buddha land, building the Buddha field, creating a sort of a land, a field, a ground, which is really conducive to this development of transformation in the direction of enlightenment, and developing a really harmonious community. I think that's one of the, you know, one of the major things that I think a Buddhist community can do is create harmony within a particular world. I mean, it's quite an achievement. When we're doing the metta bhavana tonight, well, you know, it's a bit of an achievement for how many are we? I don't know. But there's quite a few of us here this evening, and it's not vast numbers. But that's quite an achievement, just to have a group of people in a room developing loving kindness, you know, for one another and beyond. I mean, that's not bad, you know, sitting in silence. Might seem very small in relation to, you know, what's going on out there. But I mean, it's certainly, you know, a start. I mean, Bethnal Green, I mean, that wasn't... I mean, it certainly wasn't going on when we got this place, I can tell you. I mean, this place was, a burnt-out old Victorian fire station in a real mess, in a very, very rough part of town, you know, in the 1970s. So, I mean, you know, something's going on. Something's happening. Something's changing, you know, the general kind of atmosphere, you know, around this place. And, you know, this is a Buddhist centre. People do have done the Dharma here for many years. I think that we really shouldn't underestimate that. So yes, bodhisattvas gather people together. They gather together the gana, as it's called, the community. And they do it in particular ways. The first way is through generosity. Generosity. Being really generous. I mean, there's loads of ways we can be generous, but really the generosity of people inspired by this bodhisattva ideal, this altruistic dimension of going for refuge, is just giving yourselves. There's the great Walt Whitman line that our teacher Sangharakshita loves to quote, "Behold, I do not give lectures and a little charity. When I give myself." I mean, you might give lectures, you might give some charity, but essentially you're giving yourself. You're giving yourself to others as fully as you can. Giving yourself means you do what needs to be done. You do what needs to be done to create community. You know, to bring people together. To bring people together around this life of, you know, ripening and maturing. This meeting on this deep human level. You do what needs to be done. You know, whatever is before you. You're trying to aspire, I think, in the Buddhist path, to kind of remove any kind of subjective taint, any kind of subjective bias. So whoever is put before you, whatever situation is put before you, you act in the most direct way that will bring about the enhancement and transformation and enrichment of that other person. You know, I know at the centre here there's a lot of volunteers, and I think there's always room for more volunteers. Gnana Varcha's nodding. Vajrabandhu, Vajrabandhu's nodding. I mean, you can give in that way. You can give in that way. So that there is this harmonious atmosphere. It's always a delight to come to the LBC because there are always people around who are being friendly. I think that's what the volunteers do, really. Even, you know, they might be doing things like cleaning and all the rest of it, but every time I come here, I always come across friendly people. I don't know who they are. You know, I've never sort of seen them before, but they're always friendly and welcoming. I think that's a major achievement. Courteous, good manners. I don't mean in a sort of good manners in that uptight sense, but that sense of awareness, being offered a cup of tea, a seat, hospitality. I mean, these are such underestimated virtues, but I think they're really wonderful. Obviously, not just at the Buddhist Centre. I mean, wherever you are. You know, I was brought up, my mother always brought me up when we used to come up to London from Sussex when I was a little boy and sitting in a seat. I always had to get up for people and sit on her lap and make space for people. And nowadays, I'm not quite sure whether I'm going to offend somebody by getting up. They might think that they're weak or too old or something like that. You know, I hate that uncertainty. But I think that sort of thing is really wonderful. And there's all sorts of other ways in which you can give. But it's giving yourself as fully as you can. You know, and as I say, meeting whatever needs to be done for the person, for the situation before you. And the second is kindly speech. Kindly speech. And this is such an obvious one. Speaking kindly to people, courteously. There can be, I think, a kind of, you know, contemporary sort of mode, of, I don't know if it's still around, is that you've got to be authentic and just sort of tell people, you know, where they're at. You know, that's the real communication and, you know, be as brutal as possible. You sort of see it in films, don't you? And that's the truth. In other words, truth is really sort of ugly and unpleasant and like really bitter medicine that you have to swallow. I don't believe that for one minute. I mean, yeah, sure, sometimes, you know, you have to be very direct with people and it might be hard for them to hear. But it's always got to be done with kindness and courtesy. And again, this sort of sense of, you know, the well-being of the other, but also just kindly, polite and courteous speech, you know, is a really wonderful thing. I mean, it doesn't mean that you have to be incredibly eloquent and all sorts of fancy and fine words, but just that friendly welcome, that friendly greeting and meeting with others. You know, sometimes people are quite, almost seem shocked. I've noticed this in shops sometimes, that if you say thank you and please, and they kind of look at you as if you're a bit nuts, you know, that you're using these rather old-fashioned words. But I think that, yeah, kindly speech is just so, so important. And within a community, within a spiritual community, that quality of what we call rejoicing in merit, you know, really being able to say to somebody what you, the qualities that you really take delight in and you rejoice in, you're joyful about, and telling them about that. And harmonious speech, it's another really important one, harmonising speech which really brings people together. I mean, the Buddha is very, very strong about this in his own teaching. He says, you know, someone who's practicing harmonious speech will be someone who is, harmony is their delight. They are passionately fond of harmony. You know, they want to tell people, to other people, how good that other person they're talking about is. They really love that. They really want to bring people together. They want to attract them, you know, together with one another. It's a, you know, wonderful thing, I think, a quality of the spiritual community. You know, I've had, you know, very good experiences of this where somebody's told me about somebody I haven't known and about how great they are, and then I actually get to meet them, and I'm already sort of predisposed to think well of this person. And I said, oh, you're so-and-so, oh, you know, and I'm, you know, I've heard a lot about you, you know what I mean, and, you know, in a positive way. You know, and that's such an opposite when, you know, if you've heard really bad stories about somebody, you immediately, well, maybe this is just me, kind of judging them, you know, quite harshly. So kindly speech involves this harmonising, this bringing of a community together. And then they talk about, the next thing they talk about is what they call artacharya, which means something like, very hard to translate this, it means living for the meaning. Living for the meaning, living meaningfully. It could also be translated as beneficial activity. And what it's said to really mean is the most beneficial thing you can do to people is to communicate the Dharma to them. You know, communicate the teaching to them. You've got some experience of it, might not be a huge amount of experience of it necessarily. You've got some understanding of it, you've got some enthusiasm of it, about it. The best thing you can do is share it. The best thing you can do is tell people about it. It doesn't mean you're setting yourself up as a teacher, you know, but you, you know, you really want to show people this, you know, this deeper meaning to things, this deeper meaning to them. You want to share that with them. It's regarded as one of the best things you could possibly do to bring that to people. And then finally, there's what's known as samanartata. Very hard to translate this, but it means something like exemplification. You're actually living, you know, the Dharma life. You're living this Bodhisattva life happily. You're enjoying it. Doesn't mean you're perfect by any means, but you're living for it in an inspired way. You're showing that to other people. You're even sharing your successes and failures with other people. You give them a clear picture, if you like, of what it means to live this kind of life. What it means to live this kind of life. You show it to them, just in your life and in your behaviour. This is the way it's said, the prime way in which bodhisattvas create a community inspired to work together to grow and grow and to include, you know, more and more people in this, well, this altruistic dimension of going for refuge. But I think I want to end on something. I think that this, you know, if you really live this altruistic dimension of going for refuge, or you're inspired by this bodhisattva ideal, if you're thinking of giving yourself, not giving a few lectures and a little charity, but really giving yourself, it's a very open thing to do. You're opening yourself up, you know, to other people. You're really going out to other people, and that's not an easy thing to do. Inevitably, I think if you live a life which is really trying to benefit other people, you have, and you're really opening up to them, well, you start encountering things that you don't expect and you don't particularly want. I think one of the things I've found over the years as you know, being involved in a very dynamic Buddhist movement that's been very concerned to share the Dharma as widely as possible, I think inevitably, naively, getting involved so young, I thought, well, great, you know, here you are. You get in touch with this bodhisattva spirit, what they call the bodhicitta, which is this tremendous sort of energy, you know, moving in the direction of enlightenment. You open up to people, everybody's going to love it, they're going to love you, fantastic, everybody's happy, the world's saved, etc. Of course, it isn't actually like that, because people don't necessarily like you, they're not interested. You get into places and situations where you think this is going really well, only for suddenly nobody to be there anymore. I mean, when I used to do beginners classes and courses back at our Croydon Centre, you know, you get these fantastic people coming along and think, great, we're really getting somewhere. And then suddenly they don't come. They don't tell you why they haven't come anymore. You don't know what you've done wrong. Have you done anything wrong? Have they done something else? And it's really dispiriting. You know, or somebody gets involved very deeply, really good friends, and suddenly you fall out with them. You know, maybe it's because it's something you've said, something they've said. You know, and you think, well, this is, it's very tempting to think, oh, I just won't bother. You know, I'll just do my own thing. I'll just get to be with a few mates. We'll have our own little bit of Buddhism, and we'll keep all the, you know, all the difficult people out. I mean, it's still laughable, really. But of course, it just isn't like that. You can't do that. You have to learn through this process. I think one of the main ways on this altruistic dimension of going for refuge, where you're taking the Dharma into new environments, to new people, one of the main ways you work is through disappointment. One of the main ways you learn is through disappointment. You know, when your expectations are rudely upset, that is a really, really good thing. A really important thing. The Tibetan tradition is very, very strong on this. They have this tradition known as the Bodhisattva mind training. And they have phrases like this. I mean, it's sort of perverse. But they have phrases that go, which you have to meditate on. If that person who I have helped and who I have given my life to, if they turn on me and abuse me, may I see them as my greatest friend, or may I see them as a rare and precious jewel. They have sort of verses like this, because it's teaching you, well, okay, you think you're just full of this wonderful love and compassion and generosity. When people turn on you like that, who you've really helped, and you start feeling upset, hurt, irritated, angry, well, what does that say? It just shows you the limits of your love, the limits of your compassion. And you realise you've got to go much, much deeper. If you weren't involved with other people in this way, you'd never get near this. You know, if you were just in a cave meditating, I mean, you would be up against other things, but you'd never get this near this particular quality. You'd never get near this particular kind of edge of of training in love and compassion. So it's really a wide open sort of path, this Bodhisattva path, where you have to open up to people. And you are going to get, you know, maybe even a bit trashed, but you've got really good friends. You've got really good friends in the Dharma, and you're really trying to work on that self-grasping and excessive kind of self-importance, whereby you can just let go of that. You can give up all that, and you can surrender more fully to this deep, deep loving kindness, which really isn't dependent on what you're getting back. You know, I really would love to get to that point. That's what I really aspire to. You know, where whatever's coming back at you, that, you know, this loving kindness is just flowing on. In the end, in the Bodhisattva tradition, they say that the highest state of the Bodhisattva is Leela, is play. The Bodhisattva Leela. You know, there's all this stuff going on, really difficult stuff, but hey, this is fun. This is fun if you're let down. You know, this is good. I can really learn about myself, learn about life. You know, wouldn't it be boring, you know, if everybody just went along with everything you said and did and everything was smooth and okay? That wouldn't be particularly interesting. You know, it's much more exciting if people are difficult. I can say this. I'm not necessarily able to practice this, but I like the idea of saying this. So it's a very open path. It's a metaphor. What you're doing, I think, on the Bodhisattva path, metaphorically, maybe even sometimes literally, it's needed to be done. It's an embrace. It's an embrace of all your strength and quality in relation to others, so that they are strengthened by you. That's what we're doing. That's what we're trying to do, is to contact a very, very deep, if you like, energy and love and resource, a reservoir, if you like, which isn't just us, ours personally. It's much, much deeper than that. It's not a personal thing, that will really somehow infuse itself into other people. Yes, and there's lots of practical ways that we can go about doing that. That's another thing to kind of perhaps, you know, work out in another series. They're very practical ways of doing this. I'm going to end with a poem of our teacher's, Sangharakshita's, Bhante Sangharakshita. It's a poem he wrote in the early 1950s. He eventually had a lot of contact with the Buddhists who came from that untouchable background, very, very involved in all that. That's how we came to end up having our order in India. You know, he saw, you know, with his own eyes, you know, the terrible, terrible treatment of caste and untouchability when he lived in India. And on one occasion in Kalimpong, up in his Vihara, his monastery up in the northeastern Himalayas, there was a young man came to see him, a young man named Dinesh, and Dinesh told Sangharakshita his life story. And Dinesh was, you know, a Dalit, a so-called untouchable, outcast, downtrodden. And it was this life of, you know, discrimination in villages. It was this life of, you know, having to do terrible things and seeing terrible things in cities, in, you know, in factories and other ways. And Sangharakshita was very, very deeply moved by this communication. And he spontaneously wrote a poem about it. And I find this poem very interesting because I think it's a question. It's asking a question of a kind of anonymous bodhisattva, of this principle, if you like, this being of wisdom and compassion. You know, what will you say to these people? What's your answer going to be to people in this situation? I sometimes think he's perhaps asking that of himself on a deeper level. What are you going to do? You're going for refuge, you're a Buddhist monk, you're living the life. What are you going to do? I mean, it did find expression in relation to, in the end, to that community. But I think it's a terrific poem. I've just got to end with this. It's called The Bodhisattva Bodhisattva's Reply. It's questions and a kind of response. The Bodhisattva's Reply. What will you say to those whose lives spring up between custom and circumstance, as weeds between wet stones, whose lives corruptly flower, warped from the beautiful? Refuse and sediment, their means of sustenance. What will you say to them? That woman, night after night, must sell her body for bread. This boy with the well-oiled hair and the innocence dead in his face must lubricate the obscene bodies of gross old men, and both must be merry all day, for thinking would make them mad. What will you say to them? Those dull-eyed men must tend machines till they become machines, or till they are cogs in the giant wheel of industry, producing the clothes that they cannot wear and the cellophane luxury goods they can never hope to buy. What will you say to them? Or these dim shadows which through the pale gold tropic dawn from the outcast village flit, balancing on their heads baskets to bear away garbage and excrement, hugging the wall for fear of the scorn of their fellow men. What will you say to them? And wasted lives that litter the streets of modern cities, souls like butt ends tossed in the gutter and trampled on, human refuse dumped at the crossroads where civilization and civilization meet to breed the unbeautiful. What will you say to them? I shall say nothing, but only fold in compassion's arms their frailty till it becomes strong with my strength, their limbs bright with my beauty, their souls with my wisdom numinous, or till I have become like them, a seed between wet stones of custom and circumstance.